Episode 7, Season 17. I'm Lyle Troxell, and with me in the Mountain Air Room is Miles Elam. He's a pedant and curmudgeon and programmer and father. Hi.
How's it going?
It's good. Good to see you. Come on. What are you up to?
I've been coding.
Good. Coding on what?
Well, mostly coding on the GeekSpeak website.
I love it.
The conversion script still has me going. I'm working on some other things, trying to make our lives easier with regard to producing this show. Like, for example, scheduling is, well, do we have this on this calendar? And how do you say you're okay? And where does it report back? So trying to work on that. And lately also just being extremely frustrated with the database tools that I have to work with. Not the database itself. I love PostgreSQL. I hate pgAdmin.
Yeah, it's not that good.
So, yeah, I started playing around with doing my own.
Today I went ahead and updated the SSL cert. About 2 years ago I got one of those free SSL certs, but I got it from SmartCom, which actually had problems and got delisted. In any case,
they got bought,
and therefore that got resolved.
Bought by a Chinese company, right? They're originally Israeli, and then bought by a Chinese.
Anyway, every year it goes away. It's ending next month. So I got a listener texted me and said, "Hey, it's about to expire. You should probably deal with that." So I went ahead and started up. What's the free SSL? I used it all day today. I've been typing and working on it.
Let's Encrypt?
Let's Encrypt. I switched over to Let's Encrypt, which is really actually not that hard to do. Lots of script, and it was really clear. There was a Debian package for it for Ubuntu, and it was awesome. Hi, Miles. We're also with Al Luckow. Al Luckow is a designer extraordinaire and father as well, and also a host of the episode of GeekSpeak today because the storms have made it so we can't go to Las Gatos tonight. Hi.
Hello, everyone.
Good to see you, Al. It's been a while. You haven't been on the show for a while.
Yeah, it's been probably a year or more.
Yeah. You may remember Al from his many wonderful segments of Crazy USB of the Week.
Yeah, back when we were doing the radio stuff. Did you tell everybody why we're here?
Go ahead.
Because it's raining like crazy in Santa Cruz and the Bay Area, and all the roads are washed out.
And there's no power at my house.
Yes, our lovely mountain town.
And there's no power at Lyle. And it's surprising that there's power at my house because I'm only a few miles away from Lyle and we're both in the mountains. But
my house in Felton is out.
And you're out too?
Oh, we're on both sides of you, Al.
And we're in
you're in a magical
zone. You know
what?
This is going to be probably a short podcast.
Al, being a designer, you have a lot of expertise, of course, in the Adobe suite. Mostly, of course, the design tools like Illustrator and Photoshop. And I know that you're an expert on Illustrator because I've sat with you while we designed stuff before and you just whipped out your Illustrator skills.
Excuse me while I whip this out.
I, every week, actually use Adobe Audition, which is Adobe's audio software for editing the show. So I'm pretty familiar with it. It ticks me off how bad it is in some ways, but it's an okay editor. Yeah. The video version, Premiere, which is Adobe's video editor, actually has some stuff in it for audio that is awesome that Premiere does not, Audition doesn't have. So. Mm-hmm. You got an update, some new software coming out from Adobe?
Yeah, well, it's not necessarily coming out. They demoed it. It's called Adobe Voco. And what it is, it's basically Photoshop for audio. And to put the analogy in its proper perspective, you can think about people taking pictures now and, cutting the head off and putting somebody else's head on there and
Photoshopping it.
And it's become pretty commonplace and we kind of think that way. Well, that's what this Adobe Voco is with audio. And what it does is in the demo that they showed in this, it was at the Adobe Max conference in San Diego. When it's listened to 20 minutes of speech and they didn't say it needed to be like a bunch of keywords or anything. It wasn't like, say all these words. It was just 20 minutes of normal speech. After that, you can make it say anything you want in that person's voice.
Oh, no. I could basically pump in a whole bunch of content of Miles from the show.
Oh, yeah.
And then have him say anything I want.
You can just put it whatever you want to say.
That reminds me so much. Have any of you watched The Expanse?
Yes.
Yeah, there is a scene. It's not giving away any plot points, but he walks into someone's room as a police officer.
Yeah.
And he speaks into a microphone. It's kind of gibberish. Like, what is that? Just random words. And you start to hear that the owner of the apartment, her voice starts to come out, so that when he speaks, her voice comes out, and it's just a learning algorithm that.
Yeah, wow, and so basically he's speaking as her. This is the software.
And so this is
exactly
the same thing, only the next iteration.
Like, well, this is like already doing it, and they're, you know, not saying that they're going to come out with it. They're not saying that this is going to be their new, you know, killer thing. But, you know, it's one of those things that they've done it. You know, once you've done it, it's done. I mean, you could, you know, you could invent an atom bomb. You know, once you've done it, they're going to make atom bomb. I mean, you've already shown that you can do this. They've demoed it. People have been, wow, that's amazing. And now everybody's thinking, oh, that's not really that exciting now that I think, you know, and there's a lot of people talking about, you know, well, how are we going to have some kind of protection? And now Adobe is working on some sort of water print.
Mm-hmm.
Watermark. Watermark.
Yeah, with the idea
in the audio.
That then afterwards you can analyze the audio and go, oh, this was created.
And they've interviewed companies that do voice, voicing. When you say something to a computer and it says, oh, I know what that voice set is. And they're saying that the biometrics won't be, you're not going to be able to fool the biometrics. But
why?
They said because they're looking at things that aren't necessarily
replicating.
Okay. However, you know, that's
so far.
Yeah. That's what they're saying now. Yeah. And, you know,
it's a disturbing trend because right now we have a problem with assessing what is a general reality acceptance in the society. And I'm talking about, you know, in general media and people's perception of media and what is valid. Mm-hmm. Now being able to falsify people's voice easily gets really tricky.
And
public figures' voices will be available to anybody.
Well, what about phishing? Like when you call your bank and you go like, here's my information, and it's in your voice.
Right.
Like, or you call up a family member saying like, help, I'm stuck in London and all of my stuff's been stolen. And it's in their voice.
Right. And just as a really good demonstration, folks, it's just Lyle and I here right now.
Yep. Miles
isn't even here. It's just fake. Yeah.
Miles, prove that you're really here, Miles.
How would you know?
Can you prove that you're really here?
Your mama.
That's
anyway. But also it comes to mind the case of movies. We already have, you know, the movie where they resurrect a dead actor now in a Star Wars
flick. Previous rant where we talked about it in post show. Yeah.
Right. But what happens when the special edition release of some movie that everyone loves, but for some reason the original director just wants to hurt it more and more, just kick the dead horse one more time.
Easily re-render the actor's scene and use their voice saying something they never said.
Well, re-render the scene or use much the same scene, but then decide, oh, I'm going to change the dialogue. You know, to make it so it fixes the Kessel run in less than 12 parsecs, you know, to actually be a scientifically accurate statement, you know, or, you know, any number of little tweaks where someone will go like, wait, no, that's not the line. And the idea of what happens if we have the problem of fake news right now, what happens if you're able to change a broadcast to say this happened in,
yeah,
you know,
it's really dangerous.
10 years ago, and you take, you know, Wolf Blitzer's visage, have his mouth mimic a little bit more, get past that uncanny valley, and have him say anything.
I'm hoping that programmatically we can detect these things as artifice earlier than our ears can detect them. I mean, keep in mind also that if you want to have somebody say something, there are impersonators that can be really close, so much so that we can't tell the difference.
Well, I guess what we need is something that we have the technology for, which is digitally signing video records as they come out so you know that they have not been tampered with.
Yeah, and potentially using the blockchain to validate a timeline. Yeah. So news organizations basically would, as they record stuff, they would sign them and make them publicly available so later you could prove that that actually did occur.
And I don't see that happening anytime soon.
No, I don't see that.
But it as we talk about it and as the technology goes forward, I feel like we need to have that.
Yeah, and the thing that's cool is that though this as this technology becomes disruptive, we will have to solve the problem. And we have ways of doing that. Like, you know, technology is always kind of leaps and bounds on the good side and the bad side. Normally the bad side's a lot easier to do. So,
well, we have technology to solve it, but we also have technology to be able to, for example, do revision control and blame on congressional bills.
But we don't know.
But we don't.
What you're talking about is the bills right now, as they get modified, no one knows who put in what. Even though from software development, you know, I work on lines of thousands and thousands of lines of code with, you know, 30 other people, and everyone knows exactly who wrote what and when and why. Like, all of that's documented. It's really easy to do because we have the software.
It's such an intrinsic part of software development,
right.
And yet,
but it's not for law development.
Of course, yeah, it's not. Yeah,
I was just thinking about that earlier today. Like, why don't we get rid of legalese and start codifying our laws in some kind of formal language?
Right. I talked about this with you. I talked about this with you a couple of years ago,
yeah.
I think,
yeah.
Where it was, why not have the boilerplate, you know, rental agreement or lease agreement. And you say include standard lease agreement, you know, circa 2006 is when, you know, this
what I'm saying
is set
those up. Things kind of exist. But what I'm saying is not just that. I'm saying instead of the lease agreement being in English, in legalese English, mm-hmm. have it be in code and actually have all the rules not be in English.
Oh,
language.
Yeah, that'll make it more accessible.
Well, it'll be at least be clear. You won't need a judge on it. You can just run it on the processor.
What I would truly love is a change in the law where all of those end-user license agreements, whenever they change, you know, you download a new version of iTunes and mm-hmm. it goes, hey, here's this new 900-page document for you to peruse in your spare time, that you require tech companies or anyone, like, giving out software that had these agreements to provide a diff.
Yeah. But that, you know, even that, even having to go through that, I mean, most people just click. I mean, you just see that OK button and you just click it. And
that's
say,
true.
Whatever,
but at the same time, a lot of times it's a manager. I mean, one page of text or even one paragraph mm-hmm. is manageable. It's something you can skim. When it's embedded, the changes are embedded in such a ridiculously long document that when you print it out, it takes up, 30 pages, 50 pages, that they're really, and the thing is, it's not onerous to tech. If you go to any tech company and you say, "Hey, can you provide a diff between these two legal documents?"
Right.
Yes, of mm-hmm. course you can. Like
right.
you can do a line by line, mm-hmm. easily, sentence by sentence. Mm-hmm. But we don't.
No. All right, let's move on. Thank you, Miles. For the, was that wasn't even your story.
Yeah, it wasn't my story.
Oh,
I just talked.
Oh,
about
by the way, that. Audio for Photoshop, just to be clear, the idea has been out there. Google did it. They used a voice mimicking system. They called it WaveNet, mm-hmm. and they built it. But they said that it just requires too much processing power to ever make it as a consumer product. What Adobe's done is they've made it something that you can run on a computer and just. So
the other thing about this that makes perfect sense to me from a consumer market perspective is, you know how you do selfies with some software that puts a cat mask on your face mm-hmm. and it tracks your facial expressions so you look like a cat.
Mm-hmm.
You could do this with voice too. You could say something mm-hmm. with your own, you know, your mouth, you're moving, and then your voice changes into, you know, Schwarzenegger or something.
Well, that, you know, it does the mouth tracking and all that. I mean, I did a UI for a Logitech product in, I think it was like the early 2000s.
They did the same thing.
It did that.
Yeah.
You know, so that's, this is like.
But so it could be compelling to be able to modify your voice and say something to your sweetie that's
right.
Sean Connery or something.
Yeah.
Miles, tell me about, well, first off, I don't know the term for this, but when you're attacked online, bullied, people can actually cause a really negative effect to happen by calling in a SWAT team to your house. What is that called?
It's called swatting.
Swatting.
Yes.
Okay. It's a very dangerous and scary thing because, of course, SWAT team is told there's a bomb at this address, and all of a sudden the person that's being harassed online has a bomb squad breaking down their door.
Yes. And we have talked about a gentleman by the name of Brian Krebs, who...
Krebs Online? Krebs Security?
Krebs on Security, yeah. Who has been on the front line of cybersecurity and has been targeted by several people. And the way he gets around it, a lot of times he contacts the police, local police departments ahead of time saying, this is a phenomenon. So if someone calls it on my house,
please, is my name. This is what I do.
Please don't
freak out.
Yeah. And to be clear, what swatting is you call in and say there are people with, you know, automatic weapons, and they have people, and they're shooting people up, and it's a total bad. You need to get over there. They're going to hurt someone. And so, as our police departments have become more and more militarized, you end up with a very strong response showing up, mm-hmm. beating down the door, right. and coming in, you know, with full guns blazing. And people have been killed in these situations. Mm. Aside from people being hurt, or, you know, a very common scenario is pets get killed. As they run toward the door, toward someone. But
you've upset my dog.
Right. Speaking if you pets. Are, you know, if you're at home alone, you know, or it's asleep or something like that, and someone busts in your door, there are a lot of people in this country that they don't know who it is. They don't know it's police, and they pick up a weapon that right. they have in their home, legally owned and mm-hmm. registered, and they end up getting hurt. Now, or the police get hurt. Well, in this case, there's a somewhat happy ending, which is men who did send a SWAT team to his house.
To Krebs' house.
Yes. What they did, actually, was they mailed heroin to his address. And the idea being that you tip off to SWAT that this stuff is going on, you wait for the person to go, and they grab the material, they take the package mm-hmm. inside. You don't know. It's just a package. You know, all of us... or a lot of us will purchase stuff from Amazon or whatnot. You have packages all the time. And he knew that it was going to happen. So he was a step up. And in his profession, you have to be paranoid.
Right. Yeah.
Because they are out
he's
to
a,
get
he's
you.
A security expert. And so he'll do things like find out who wrote a certain malware and help the police catch those people.
Right.
So he's on the front lines of fighting.
He is a braver man than I am.
Well, he doesn't have a small child either. So,
But anyway, some folks have been put away. But at the same time, the person was put away, sentenced to 41 months, a Ukrainian man.
Mm-hmm.
And I think of 41 months. When you SWAT someone, that is attempted murder.
Yeah.
Like, there is no doubt in my mind that that equates to attempted murder. You are trying to get that person injured or killed.
It was a Ukrainian guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're lucky also, they even got the guy at all.
Right, so that's the thing, is they were actually able to get a prosecution
from the mural right there
outside of the area.
And so they sent him heroin. I remember we covered the story quite a while ago. It's interesting that they sent him heroin, and he was still able to, you know, talk to the police, go, hey, someone sent me heroin, it's my mailbox.
No, I mean, what did he do? He knew about the plot ahead of time.
Yeah. And so he contacted authorities and said this is happening.
Yes, knew that this was going to happen ahead of time.
Yeah, that's good.
And gather the evidence online to be able to say...
Scary. Well, at least there was a sentence, and it was an international sentence. So in some sense, the police force are starting to understand, or, you know, law enforcement is trying to understand the kind of more complex situations.
Yes. But, yeah, it's...
So recently...
All hail Brian Krebs for his bravery, but also the fact that this stuff is going on and it's real.
Yeah. The editor-in-chief of Quartz, Kevin Delaney, recently interviewed Bill Gates. And they talked about a lot of things. But the thing I want to mention was that Bill Gates was suggesting that as we create more and more robotic jobs, meaning robots take over more and more work, that why don't we tax the labor of robots? And the idea being here is that the robot comes into a warehouse environment or whatever and takes over a role of an individual. It used to be that that individual would have gotten in a salary, and that salary would have been taxed, and that tax rate would have come into the United States and helped us in our society. Instead, a robot's being put in place there, and it's not getting a salary, but it is achieving work. And therefore, what if we just say, you know what, robots can get taxed at some amount, and that tax also goes into the federal, you know, governments and local state government as well. And I think the general concept here is that this would help with the removing jobs that we're going to see as robots become more and more prevalent. What do you think?
The counter argument to that is that always in the past, when there has been displacement due to automation, new jobs, new sectors have opened up.
Yes. That is the past.
Yes. And I also wonder about, yes, okay, you're on an assembly line and you have a robot. Or let's say we get to the point where robots can pick our produce and we don't need mm-hmm. migrant labor for that anymore. What about the things that AI takes care of?
Yes. Yeah,
because a lot of our jobs, especially as many of the menial jobs have been overtaken by automation, whether that automation be in the form of a bulldozer taking the place of hundreds of people digging ditches for weeks, you know, being able to do it within, you know, a couple of hours.
Mm-hmm.
What happens when you have things like AI where it's not a physical entity anymore? It just replaces all the people that it previously would push paper or now send emails.
This is appropriate for all situations where automated systems can take over labor. And the thing is, at some point, when tractors became available and you no longer had as much, you know, digging ditches workforce necessary because you had tractors, somebody made a lot of money off of that. Instead of individual companies making money off of that that build robots, why don't we improve society in general and make a minimum salary for everybody, right? A minimum income for everybody, and pay for that by taxing automated workforces. It seems like that would be a step in the right direction to a society where humans didn't have to work and were being taken care of.
Well, you're also looking at, like, when Mile mentioned the AI business, these robots are gonna, you know, we're dealing with higher capacity processing. They're going to be able to find the kind of tax loopholes that we couldn't even dream of.
Right.
Good point.
They're going to be like, oh.
Yeah, it's true. The person, the one that can get the best AI.
These robots aren't paying taxes. They just keep right. thinking of new things.
That is something that I was reading an article not too long ago talking about. We have AI and automation in areas where it tends to hurt people who don't make as much money mm-hmm. to begin with. You know, a line worker in the auto industry, you know, made a decent salary, but they weren't wealthy.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, they were a blue collar worker. They went in and they did their job and worked hard. Strenuous work. I mean, mm-hmm. not to say that someone else doesn't work hard, but I mean, a strenuous laborer.
Sure.
And when I think of, I'm sorry, I totally lost my train of thought.
It's okay. You look like you're contemplative.
See, a robot would have not done that.
When you take that away, when you get to the point where the thought process, where you have AI that can beat the champion Go players, when, but also the areas where right now they are the high-paying jobs, the lawyers. Right now, lawyers charge by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
In general, and they get paid top dollar for that at the highest, I mean, at the top levels. But what happens when you have an AI that someone voices an argument in court and the case law that's relevant to it automatically pops up with the most relevant counter argument for that?
Okay,
in charged by the second.
Yeah. Well, first off, software like that exists, not necessarily the counter argument, but all the data relevant to an argument. That kind of software exists. It's extremely expensive, and high end law firms spend a lot of money on it. So an individual small law firm is not going to have access to that kind of AI. And that AI already exists. It's just assistive AI. It's not.
Right. But I mean, that takes away paralegal work. That takes away a lot
of. Well, you also have to have people processing that data and stuff. I mean, it's unclear where the boundary is, where it's replacing people, and where it's just making the effective job, you know, better for them. And I think you're supporting my feeling that Bill and I feel
Bill Gates.
That it makes sense to set up a situation early on where we start making our society better based off of things, not just having the companies do better.
But then we also have to decide who we are as human beings. I can't speak for every culture. There's a great deal of nuance in among 7+ billion people on the planet. But within the U.S., there is a very strong correlation drawn between someone's job and their output and their worth. So
they'll find other things to feel worthy of.
But if you have many of the basic but necessities of life.
That's not the problem. That's not the problem I'm addressing. I mean, granted, it's going to be weird to all of a sudden have the job that you did. You know, I've been a bus driver for 30 years, and now there's a machine that can drive better than me in every single way. I can no longer be a bus driver, and that's part of my fulfilling of my life. Whether we say, well, too bad, good luck, or here's some money and your life is, you're okay, you don't have to work, go ahead and do what you want to do. Those are two different patterns, and I think the latter is better. Now, you're saying that potentially, well, if you say, hey, that line of work is no longer there, horses just aren't important, you can't be a horseshoer anymore, go do something else. First off, that makes sense. It worked in the past because we didn't have the switchover we have now, but it also is because every job is going to transition at the same time. Like, you can't think of a job that won't slowly get taken over by an artifice.
Well, I guess there's a question. There is precedent in the world for stuff like this happening, which is when you're building furniture, for example. Mm-hmm. Right now, the vast majority of furniture is mass-produced.
Mm-hmm.
And is in some ways higher quality. In other words, it is uniform and much faster in terms of output than a human being could possibly do, could dream of doing. But in Japan, you have people who know how to make specific types of joints and have the artistry of furniture building subsidized, I guess, a better way, that it's a part
it's
of a cultural heritage
to hold on to that skills. Yeah, sure.
Right. And so I wonder if that's going to be the case where the ability to be at the forefront of just about any industry is beyond the ability of any single human being to do on a productive level. So do you have people?
I would say most manufacturing is like that already.
Right. So do you teach people the skills for how that is done to make sure that it stays within human culture, stays within our society, that there is not so much a fallback, but just some part of a heritage that falls through?
I agree that that's an important aspect, and culturally that makes sense that we'd protect that, just like Japan is doing mm-hmm. with woodworkers or swordsmith as well. But this is more, for me, it's more about how our economy would grow and change over time. We have international businesses that have no borders. They're going to be the ones that have control of robots. They're going to replace human beings with robots at a level that mm-hmm. is unprecedented. And the question is, as a society, do we want to say, that's cool, good on you, you're going to be rich and powerful, awesome, hope that you make stuff for us and take care of us in the future? Or do you say, hey, that's great, and you're going to get taxed for that, and that's going to go back into our society? So that as that wealth of power and energy gets produced, the robotic takeover, if you will, of all labor, that benefits all humanity instead of just individual corporations, smaller subsets of
humanity. You do have to decide what each individual robot is making. Like to Miles' point, you know, you're saying that, you know, a lawyer might have to spend hours to figure something out. A computer figures that out in a second. You know, yeah. You have to figure out how much is this computer, how much is this robot making? You know, did you ever read that or listen to that podcast? It was an escape pod, and it was about this robot that it was a futuristic society, and the robot walked in the street and is like, oh no, and there's a bus coming, and it's like, oh, I'm gonna die, you know, because it's like, I can't get out of the way, the bus is bigger than me, it's gonna smash me, calculated all this kind of stuff, it's like, I'm gonna have to say goodbye to all my friends, and it was literally a second.
Oh, like a millisecond.
It was like a couple seconds before the bus hit him, and the entire story was just him going and saying, "Hey, you know, X145, it's me. You know, doesn't look like I'm going to be around for much longer. Oh, really? What's wrong? Well, you know, I'm going to get hit by this bus. You know, and he's doing that, and he's saying it. He's saying it to like
intellectually
a dozen,
communication. It's
yeah,
easy to fat.
It's like fast. It's like to a dozen friends at the same time, all within this 1 second. You know, and it's kind of a cool idea, but then you really think that's how computers work. You know, I mean, they don't need, you know, to sit around and pontificate. They can get, in an instant, they can get, you know, gigabytes of information, you know?
Yeah.
And he just, in the whole story was like, you know, 45 minutes long. It was just him saying goodbye to all his friends. And they're, yeah, okay, well, you know, remember that time we did this? And, you know, they just went through the whole mm-hmm. thing. And, yeah.
It is true that the figuring out how much labor is being saved, if you will, by a machine is tricky because, of course, if you had 50 people doing this one job or you have one robot doing the 50 job, right. if you always say, well, you have to assume that you get taxed on the labor you're replacing as a human being. So if you have highly efficient human beings doing it, that's how much you get taxed versus a machine that can do it much faster. It's an interesting problem.
There's also the what is when you say taxing a robot. Per robot, per the equivalent
per
human
labor.
Output?
Yeah, I think that's what
or
Gates
the
is suggesting.
Taxing the money that's made by the company that's using the robots and say, you just a robot, a flat robot tax. You know, you've got 10 robots.
Well, that's what I wonder about a flat robot tax is, like what happens if you have one robot or 10 robots? That does make a difference in terms of output and does make a difference in the number of people that have been displaced.
Mm-hmm. I think it has to do with displacement of people. If you didn't implement the robot, you're going to have all those people be paid and all those people pay taxes on what they're being paid. So you're compensating society for that. And then you use that tax to subsidize people's lives.
I am still very much in the skeptical or pessimistic area of this, where if you take away the necessity for people on a large scale, when you have political movements or when you have people who have the control of these robots or have control over these systems, what is the incentive to treat humanity as anything but cheap and expendable?
Wait a second. What?
You want to give people, you know, or, and Bill Gates, you know, tax the robots so that people are able to lead more fulfilling lives, that they have this money to be able to pursue whatever they would like to pursue because the basic needs have been met through automation. Or, you know, they're adding it however they want, or they're buttressing some knowledge to make sure that it still gets passed on, or whatever. Where is the break, as it were, on the tendency of society with regard to efficiency. Mm-hmm. I mean, fascism is extremely efficient.
Sure, sure, sure.
But it also devalues the individual, especially with their lack of contribution to the whole. How do you prevent...
I think you're focusing on this outcome of society being benefited, which is kind of a tack on that I did. Gates in his video thing does not talk about that. This is much more about you employ your company, you employ 50 people. Then you have a robot and you no longer include those 50 people. You cut the price potentially, but also you keep the revenue up. But you also have costs on the robot, but no longer is there any taxable income for all of that work. The only taxable income is on your net profit. But of course, you invest all the money back in your business so the business grows. So at one point, equivalent of 50 employees were paying taxes. Then you switch to automation, and no longer is that happening. Though the same amount of work is being done, and the same amount of product is being produced, you have a problem in your society when you do that, because of the lack of income tax.
And only if you value human life.
No, I'm talking about just in society in general. If the U.S. government right now no longer got taxes off of income because there was nobody working anymore, you don't have a federal government. Like, there's a serious problem when you stop hiring people. It's not just for the individual suffering.
I am totally on board with you with regard to the only way to grow an economy is to grow a thriving middle class that has the money to be able to contribute to that economy. What I am saying is, what happens if you have derailed that, where the idea of you want to get tax revenue from robots to be able to go back into society to do this is predicated on the notion that you want to keep what we have now, or make it better according to our values,
I think it's a pretty valid way of deciding how to govern the society.
As opposed to someone going, well, there you have a whole bunch of people who are useless.
Well, you know,
is that your feeling?
No.
This
is not altogether different from the current rhetoric of saying, like, we don't need the immigrants. They are a drag on us, the us versus them, to be able to say we don't need
them.
There's
I have something to say about this. I don't. I can say something somebody else said. It was Elon Musk who was backing this universal basic income idea.
Sure.
And that was what they're saying. He's saying that the trend of robot automation is increasing, and millions of people are going to be out of work. And he's saying, you know, he's one of the proponents of the economic solution of saying just pay people regardless of whether they find work or not. And it's a system of wealth distribution. Now, that sounds a little funny to us.
It doesn't sound funny to me at all. It sounds like the perfect solution to the problem.
Right, but the democracy.
But do you remember in the first year that Obama, the year before he was elected during the campaign trail, when he off the cuff in a conversation said to someone who turned out to be a GOP operative, but share the wealth. Just those three words out of the context of everything else that he was saying was latched onto, and that became a major talking point in opposition to him. That when you talk about distribution of wealth,
but that's because
there's a huge portion of society, both in this country and in other places, that is a rallying cry for something to fight against.
I get that, Miles. And at the same time, the way that society is going to change as more robots can do and achieve more things, and I'm including AI in that, as we automate work in general, you're going to have that problem where there will be so much wealth out of this. It's insane the amount of wealth that will emerge. And what I mean by that is that your society, in the sense that the amount of people that are actually doing work lessens, but more output happens. Mm-hmm. That is very incredible. That's like the Industrial Revolution, right? It's the same type of thing at another scale. And we can do that in a couple different ways in a society. We can completely ignore it and just accept that a lot of people get really wealthy and everybody won't have work and the society will fall apart at some level. There'll be a massive, horrible experience. Or we can try to plan for that by putting in places that keep our society in a stable way. And part of that, I think, is universal health care. I mean, it's universal income. I think that's going to be kind of like it just is going to emerge. Now, at the same time, I like science fiction. And I do recognize the craziness that I'm saying in this. But when you see Gates doing this and Musk doing this, you can see that this is going to happen. It's just whether it's going to happen in the United States or not. Somewhere it's going to happen. I mean, that's my feeling on it, at least.
Or rather, in other places it is starting to happen. But yeah.
Yeah. But you're right. It does not fit the American zeitgeist right now. I think that shit's going to change. I'm hoping that will change. But it might be 100 years. You're right. It might take a long time. You're very pessimistic tonight. Is it because you're around people today?
I am skeptical.
He's been around fish all day.
You went down the Monterey Bay Crime?
Wait, did you guys not notice the election we just had? Like, and many of the messages there?
I was trying
like,
not to think about it, actually.
Thanks a lot, Miles.
Yeah.
No, of course. No, I get that you're being pragmatic. I totally get that. And can't we just dream a little bit here? You just don't think it's going to happen.
Just say
no.
Yes.
I don't say. I'm not saying that I think it's going to be one way or another. I have my preferences. I am more speaking along the lines of how do we frame that argument to make sure it does happen, rather than Bill Gates said we should do that. Bill Gates has said a lot of things that people have been like,
nah. Okay,
I don't care if malaria gets cured or not.
So Elon Musk saying on an interview somewhere, I saw the interview too, it was really interesting, but him saying that there should be universal general, what do they call it?
Universal basic income.
Basic income.
It was a CNBC interview, November 4th. Sure. Yeah. Okay.
So when he says that, that's interesting, but that's much more like, you know, yeah, and we're going to go to Mars too. I mean, that's the way he thinks. It's large in scale. Mm-hmm. It's not about practicality. Gates saying, hey, we should just tax labor that's not human labor in some way actually makes more logical sense to me, in the sense that if I'm a company and I can see, look, I'm employing this amount of people, but I can switch to robots and employ a lot less people and make money off of that. Oh, but they're going to be a tax, but it's still profitable for me to do it. It's not going to stop me from automating, but the society won't fail as much as it would fail if it didn't have that in place. So to me, it's a small step in the right direction.
But
that's
then,
what makes sense.
Then you have the head of Carl's Jr. Hardee's, where there's an industry where automation is definitely in the conversation of getting rid of the people working the fast food job, who is vehemently against a minimum wage increase and actually has been verbally abusive when describing his own employees, and he is now a cabinet member of the current administration. So that's where I get my back and forth there.
But you're kowtowing to the bad situation we're currently in. Instead of saying, yes, I agree, I would vote for that, I would push that forward. It makes sense that companies that slowly get rid of their labor get taxed in some way to benefit society. Don't you support that, Miles? Or are you saying...
I love your optimism. I really do.
Well, it's not about optimism. Do you want to just roll over?
No, I absolutely don't.
Well, you're rolling over.
I absolutely am not.
So let me hear you. What are you going to say? How are you going to fight this? Make an argument.
But there's my question. I mean, for me, the argument seems self-evident. You, in order to have a thriving economy, you need to have people have a sufficient income, whatever that form may be, that allows them to purchase the goods that you're selling.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem to be the model that some are working on, and I don't know how to get people to change their mind. If I knew how to do that, I think that a lot of elections would be going a very different way.
Okay, so
a lot of our current society would be shaped in a very
different way.
So
three of us clearly totally support a universal basic income. Okay, I'm glad to hear that. I guess I'm not hearing your response other than cautiousness.
Okay, that's fair.
All right. I'm sorry. Let's talk about virtual reality, shall we? Virtual life.
Oh, we'll talk about what would happen if... well, Linden Labs. Remember Linden Labs?
Yeah. Didn't they make Second Life?
Second Life, yeah. I ran across this...
I have a Second Life character, I think.
Yeah, me too. And you know what's funny is I hadn't thought about it in years, and I ran across this article that Second Life is actually becoming a very popular place for people who are disabled, because they can go there and socialize and do whatever they want. They can hang out. I mean, Second Life, for those who don't know, is it was one of the first real virtual worlds that you could have a character and you could go places.
It's kind of like a first-person video game.
Yeah, I think in 2006, it was the height of Second Life's membership. It was at 1.1 million members. And once you're in there, you can sell stuff. People were selling land, building houses. There was actually a Second Life millionaire on the cover of Business Week. You know, somebody who actually made $1 million within the whole world. And
real million?
A real $1 million, yeah. You get Linden bucks, or I don't know, there's something, yeah, and then there's like 300 every dollar. Mm-hmm. There's some way to do it. But now it's dropped a lot. It's like around 800,000 users. And that's time. I mean, when you look at how exponential the internet is, I mean, that's nothing.
Group,
yeah. Because Facebook's got 1.86 billion users. So given the amount of internet that's available now and how everybody has computing, you know, compared to them, it should be much larger, and it's shrunk. But there's some communities that have thrived, and it's the disability community. And they've, people go in there who are blind or deaf or have autism or PTSD or whatever, and they can meet other people that are in the same situation, or you know, they're able to socialize, and it's sort of like it's becoming a science fiction thing. And I was like, the more I read about that, the more it just, you know, they took the life of a woman who went in there, and she got Parkinson's, and she ended up building the cabin that she used to go to all the time. And she'd go there and invite people over, and she had all these friends. I mean, these are thriving communities of people in here. And,
That's really cool. I mean, it makes a lot of sense.
I thought, remember you were saying, you know, you had a second life. I thought, you know what, I think I had a you know, character, and I went to Second Life, which of course I haven't gone to in a million years, and I thought, I wonder what it was, and I just searched my email for secondlife.com, and sure enough, I saw my membership stuff, and I logged in.
That's cool.
And the last time I was there was March of 2006.
Wow. And you just logged in after the story.
I just logged in. That's great. I was like, my name was Alan Lowell or something.
You all get last names based on like random choice.
I don't know what it was. Yeah. But, and I realized I didn't have any clothes on or something. You know, I forgot how the whole thing worked, but I was standing there naked, and figured out how to put clothes on and everything. It's actually still kind of cool.
Yeah, it is kind of cool.
And I can see how people could get into it.
Well, it's interesting because if you're in a situation where it's hard for you to be mobile by yourself, mm-hmm. you know, you can't travel and such, it does make sense to participate in online world. I mean, I think that's a lot of interacting in an online society makes a lot of sense, especially since if your interest, of course, also is rare,
right.
Like bearded dragons or something, mm-hmm. you can find other people that are really interested in them from all over the world and all meet in one place. It's, mm-hmm. and it's kind of a similar to that in the sense that you can't travel as easily.
Speaking of traveling, there's, what is it? Agoraphobia, where you're afraid of going out or sure. there's a mm-hmm. lot, there's a lot of those people that there's a place that specifically they're called Virtual Ability Island. And it's actually five islands and people can buy homes there. And,
very cool.
This woman, Alice Kruger, started this thing and, she had a few disabled friends and it's just grown and it's just, you know, it's the kind of thing you just imagine, you know, you think about all these, you know, snow crash, you know, how it's all the people are in the virtual world
the Neal Stephenson novel Snow Crash.
Right. Neal Stephenson's novel. And what's the new one? All based in the '80s, stuff, Ready Player One.
Sure.
You know, Ready Player One, all this stuff's happening within these, like, by the way, two great books that everybody who's listening should have read by now. If not, Snow Crash, Neal Stephenson.
If not, you have homework.
And Ready Player One, I forget who wrote
there
that.
There will be a test.
Ready Player One was actually written by someone who came on our show, actually, the author of the show. Ernest Cline came on to Geek Speak on August 13th, 2011, and talked all about the book. It was a fun interview.
Oh, yeah.
It was really interesting.
That's a great book. Yeah. You won't be able to put it down. But, you know, it's nice to see these kind of things happening. And I can't believe that my account is still... I mean, you should try to get in and into your...
We should on GeekSpeak through that today.
I know, because it's, you know, and as far as I can tell, it's... Well, you can upgrade your account and pay something. I wasn't paying anything. It's free, you know. But then you can have the deluxe model where... Like I was walking around and there was people walking around and there were some women dancing and I'm like, and there's like a radio station that plays and it's a real radio station. It was just really brought back a lot of memories, you know, from that time when it was so exciting, you know, and now people are like dropping into Minecraft and there's all this, actually a lot less resolution rendering.
I wonder if Second Life is going to have a second life
actually
with VR.
Actually, they are. They're planning to do a new one, and it's really freaking people out because a lot of people have invested a lot of money. Like, you know, you're looking at, you know, spending thousands of dollars to build a house, and you're
really
buying
cool
things.
If you could migrate your Second Life,
yeah, they said they're not going
into virtual reality.
They're not going to migrate it, okay. But they also said that they're not going to shut down Second Life anytime. To give you an example, even at this point, the Second Life creators redeemed almost $60 million in aggregate last year through Linden Lab.
Wow.
The Linden Lab makes most of its money from rental of Second Life islands to residents.
Wow.
So that's $60 million. They're not going to shut it down. I mean, they may come up with a new fancier realm, but there's so many things that they can't even actually at this point upgrade the system because too many people have invested too much money in it, so they can't do any major changes.
Interesting. They've got kind of this weird this weird problem of being stuck at a certain level.
Right.
Yeah, interesting.
But it's still a money generator and people are in there doing stuff. And
if you haven't been on Second Life for a while or if you've never been on, it's fun. I'm sure making an account is still free. By the way, I also interviewed Neal Stephenson about his most recent book, Seven Eves, which I did not like. I trashed it in some ways. It was fun talking with him.
Mm-hmm.
His other work and some of his collective works is fantastic. But Seven Eves, I didn't really get into. And then after doing that interview, and that's you can listen to that interview on the... let's see, June 20th, 2015 episode of Geek Speak. And there's totally spoilers, so don't... Well, I don't know. Go ahead and listen to it, because I don't think you're going to like the book. But other people really like the book. And I didn't tell him I didn't like the book, really.
Of course not.
But any case, yeah. Cool. Second Life. Awesome. I should log in. I'll definitely do that. Hey, Miles, I hate to do this, because I feel like we just had this kind of depressing conversation about the society. And it feels like I kind of left it with, oh, well... sucks to be you kind of space. And I'm sorry about that. But now you have an even worse story about software development in San Francisco, specifically Uber.
Yes, we've talked in the past. In fact, the last show that went live, we talked about... I guess it wasn't last one. It was several ones ago where I had an extended conversation about diversity within tech. Mm-hmm. It's been a recurring theme the show. And in this case, an Uber engineer...
Susan Fowler.
Yes, who was a response engineer. So someone who works with making sure the systems stay up, not necessarily in the new code that goes out. That's usually referred to as a SWE, is the person who makes the code. And then the SRE is the one you make sure that
what
the code stays
up. What does SWE stand for? Software
engineer.
Software engineer, yeah. Okay. So I'm a
SWE? Yes.
And then there's people that make sure this code stays up. And like...
And the servers, DevOps, and the infrastructure,
DevOps part of that?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's an SRE.
I'm going to call you SWE.
Yeah, I would like that.
Site reliability engineer.
Yeah. Okay.
Is SRE, and her experience at Uber, where she was very excited about it, and it really does bear, like, you have to read it to get the full brunt of what she's talking about.
She joined in November of 2015 and just left and wrote a big blog entry that you're summarizing.
Yeah, right this mm-hmm. past December, yeah. And to give a point of perspective, when she started, it was about 25% women.
Oh, that's actually pretty...
In SRE.
Okay.
And by the time she left, it was 3%.
There might have been a problem.
And just thing over and over again, and a lot of items that people are going, my goodness, that is blatantly illegal.
Yeah, I mean, the story she tells is like the first day she gets hired, her manager hits on her through text. And it's mm-hmm. actually business text.
Right.
And actually suggests having a relationship.
Right. And she reports it to HR, which you're mm-hmm. supposed to do. And right. HR said, essentially, oh, well... This is the first we've heard for a report for this guy, and we don't want to ruin his career. So, but we'll give you an opportunity. You can transfer to a different team.
See, where did these HR people get trained? Like, where did they even think that this is an appropriate response?
That's the other part about it is that this was not the first one.
Well, that's
they would tell her.
What she finds out later, she found other people that had the same experience
right,
as this guy.
That he had a series of, this is the first time has happened. But he was considered a high performer, even though her reviews always came back showing that she was a high performer, but they were more than willing to throw her under the bus.
Hmm.
And
I wonder if this guy had had lots of stock or was it some power position? I mean, the thing I don't understand is that it's illegal doing what they did.
Yeah.
Like I'm surprised she didn't sue the company for this. I mean, I don't get why. The HR staff has put the company at giant risk in not getting rid of this guy. So from a business perspective, even, it doesn't make much sense. Except that you can push people around, I guess, when you've got power.
She did talk about an unrelated aspect of Uber where a lot of people were undercutting their direct manager so that they could get their job. And it was a common culture thing.
Doesn't sound like a very healthy culture.
It does not. And the CEO has since come out, just after that blog entry was posted, the CEO made a statement of like, I'm talking about how he is surprised and dismayed by what's going on. He's going to do something about it. And at the same time, when this is part of your company culture, if you're the CEO and you don't know about it,
you're not good at your job.
You either have no idea what's going on in your company or you're lying. Right. And you just didn't care until it was bad PR. And
it's bad PR.
And it's bad PR.
I mean, Ben and I talked a while ago about this campaign after the airport, after the ban, the immigration ban that Trump signed, there was a whole bunch of protests at airports. Mm-hmm. Ben actually went to the airport and actually protested, and we talked about that on an episode of Geek Speak. And in that situation, we talked about the context of Uber not stopping their drivers and therefore people pulling support from Uber, getting out of that. And that was not, and we covered, when we talked about this, we talked about how that was kind of a silly response because it really didn't fit the crime, if you will. Uber didn't do anything really that bad in this context. And then at that time, Ben was saying there's other reasons potentially not to use Uber. And then there was this, I went on a trip to Dallas recently for work, and my colleague that he and I traveled the entire time together, he was saying, we got to use Lyft because Uber's so bad. And I was like, well, yeah, except that Lyft isn't great either. So we were like toggling. He would do Lyft and I would do Uber, and we were kind of traveling that way and kind of debating whether, you know, which one of these was better to use.
Or just a standard cab.
Or a standard cab.
Aren't they both, a lot of times the Uber drivers are Lyft drivers?
Oh, yeah.
They're the same people.
That's one of the things we did is we just talked to them the entire time. In Dallas, the three people we actually drove with, one of them was a Lyft, two were Uber. Both those Uber drivers no longer had their Lyft thing registered and set up because it was a little harder to deal with. But they had been Lyft drivers before. But
by and large, I don't have anything against the individual drivers anyway.
No, of course not. The drivers aren't the problem, right?
Right?
But this is interesting because in that situation of that Uber decided not to stop, you know, not to support the taxi drivers did a strike kind of for an hour. Uber didn't do that. That was the reason to pull support from Uber. That's not a very good reason. But this, to my mind, is a good reason to not support Uber. If their internal culture is such that they're taking advantage and treating people like crap, I don't want to support them.
This is also an aspect of if you are a developer, do you work for Uber? This is a good reason to say, like, no, even if I get a job offer that I don't want to support this company and this culture, that you need to fix things before, you know, anyone even considers going to work for them. And this means that men need to not go there.
Yes.
For the most part, what we're hearing is that it's already a hostile work environment for women who are there and for the women who are still there.
Well, 25% at one point and now at 6%?
3%.
Yeah, that's...
That it needs to be on, you know, high-performing men that go like, no, I'm not going to work here anymore, or I'm not going to go for a job interview there. I'm going to look someplace else, even though Uber has one of the – it is kind of now one of those marquee places to work at.
Right. I mean, a few reasons why it's a marquee place, of course, is they have an immense amount of money, which means they can invest in kind of crazy ideas. They're working on self-driving vehicles. They'll probably have the largest fleet of self-driving vehicles. And those are some interesting technical problems to work on. Like, it's compelling.
When you're working at scale, any company that is a certain size, you're working at a scale where the problems become substantively different.
Yeah.
More complex or just a little bit south of normal that you have to really push yourself, and it attracts other people who are at the top of their game and trying to do things to eke out that little extra bit of performance. That can be a very invigorating work environment.
I mean, for example, Uber clearly does need to solve the traveling salesman problem, which is a classical software problem. Well, not really, it's a software problem. It's an example of difficult
non-polynomial time where you can't predict how long the algorithm is going to take to finish.
And they actually literally do have to solve that problem, which is kind of funny. But it's depressing, and I think you're right that being a software developer in Silicon Valley, the right way to suggest to the people is don't go work for Uber, like, until they solve this problem. But how are they going to solve this problem? Because Uber's not going to go away. No matter what occurs at this point, they're too well entrenched, right? Hopefully they'll compensate and improve their work environment. But how does a company like that rebrand itself from an incident of this sort? I mean, for you and I will always question whether Uber's a good business. Like,
I would question it up until I start hearing more stories from people who are marginalized saying, hey, this has actually been a great place for me to work. I've been here for the last, 18 months.
And you could hear that right now. Because one little story is not going to tell you.
Yeah, although this is the most strident that I've heard. This is not the only story that I've heard.
Yeah.
And the thing that was different about this story, or that stuck out, was how well she documented, how well she tracked, and how well she actually went back to HR every time. She did everything that people say you're supposed to do.
Right.
It's like, why didn't you say anything? Why didn't you report anything? Why didn't you say the emails?
That is the damning episode of this, right? I mean, it is very easy for people to run into jerks like this. Like, this is not... Mm-hmm. I mean, sure, that is a problem, but that's why we have human resources and rules and regulations around that. That is why businesses spend a lot of time and energy training people on this kind of situation, because it does not work for them in the long run for this to occur. They've been losing staff. They've been, you know, mm-hmm. if they went from 25% to 3% women in that role, that means they've been losing people that are good at their job.
Well, we don't know why they dropped that, yeah, that percentage. Well, I can tell you right now, just in every company that I've been involved with, most often, as soon as you get to a certain capacity, you start moving coding overseas.
Well, you know, yeah, but moved. Keep in mind, the ratio of women to men changed. It's not an amount of people. They right. moved from 25% women to 3% women.
Right.
Which That's is, because yeah. it was a hostile environment.
And when you go overseas, the ratio of men of women to men improves.
Does it?
Yes, compared to the U.S., yeah.
Yeah.
It could be better, yeah.
So, yes, the thing I don't get is how will they... I don't know how when I'll be able to say, oh, yeah, Uber's an okay company. I don't know when all
but
be able to do
and
that.
This is something also important to say. We are talking about Uber right now, and that's what the article was about. But this is not specific
this is happening
to
everywhere.
Uber.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You have companies like Apple, Google, Facebook coming out and having, I believe it's called an EEO-1 report to say what their diversity numbers are like, what their retention levels are like, things like that. And they're the ones who are stepping up and actually saying it. The numbers aren't that good. In fact, they're pretty atrocious when you look at them.
Yep.
But they're actually stepping up and doing it. You have companies like Uber and others that aren't even publishing that data. And right. chances are it's worse than what the Apples, the Facebooks, and the Googles are having. So
you made some clear statement that I want to reiterate, and that is that if you're a guy in Silicon Valley, a software developer, I know that a lot of software engineers and people in tech listen to the show, but you need, in that position of
privilege,
you need to take advantage of your privilege to push forward things that make it better for other people. That's part of how we make the society better. So if you're aware of an employee that's getting away with, you know, treating people badly, you need to step up as well and go to HR and say, this person should not be working here, or this person, you know, cannot be managing people. Because you stepping up to do it too, you're, as horrible as this sounds, your voice is heard better. That's what the privilege is about. So
reminds me of a certain manager at Feed the Monster so many years ago.
That we got fired.
Yeah. At any rate.
You don't want to tell that story?
No.
All
right. One of the things that comes to mind also with regard to anything on the internet that you read, you never read the comments.
Oh, God, except you read the comments on this article?
Well, I didn't read the comments on the article because it's just a blog post. And I don't blame her for not having open commenting on that article.
No.
That would have
right.
been...
No. And she also does not ever name him.
Right.
Because she's talking about the...
There are several people at fault there.
Right.
So,
no, that's what I'm saying, is that she's talking about the culture that existed at the company, right? There's the HR manager that didn't do anything. Like, there's a lot of people
the manager's manager.
But she's talking about this happened at the company. And I think that's a better way of dealing with it, because if the company just goes, oh, yeah, those five people, they don't work anymore, that's not really the problem.
Right. So Slashdot, this is basically one of the first tech blogs.
Think of it as Reddit for Miles and my generation.
Right. I was reading Slashdot on a regular basis in 97, 98, something like that.
Yep, I was as well. When I was doing a Zine, an online magazine, I was reading Slashdot regularly. Yeah.
Right. And it's still around. They still have people talking. And I go and read and it aggregates links from various news organizations. Very few things that are generated within Slashdot itself. It's mostly aggregating news from other places. Mm-hmm. And then people commenting on that news. And sometimes the comments are very interesting, where you will have something like a talk about rocketry, and someone who actually works, you know, building with rockets will chime in and tell you how something works or doesn't work. And I go to this article where they're linking to a story of an engineer having a horrible time at Uber. And while there are some people coming forward saying, like, yeah, as much as people want to believe that sexism is imaginary, like, this happens, there are, I'm seeing two or three that are questioning the veracity. that are saying, I don't know if that's true, who didn't even bother reading the article. They saw the headline and then started commenting, right, which is a common thing. But also coming from a point of skepticism, like, well, if she did this, why didn't she do that?
Okay, but Slashdot is rated by the users, and things get bubbled up and bubbled down depending on ratings. How'd that go? Did those things get filtered down, or did they stay prominent?
They're
prominent.
They're prominent. There's a lot of folks that are bumping up to people saying, no, sexism, racism, ableism, these are all real things. And there are other people who are getting modded up for saying, yeah, that's a nice straw man. Like, what are you talking about there? This is
Miles, are you gonna stop using Uber?
I never have, actually.
Oh, okay.
That's a long story. I can talk about it some other time.
All right. Well, thanks. Yeah, don't read the comments and things like this.
Well,
of course,
the other
way to do it is read the comments, participate, and try to push the tide.
If you're not the person that's being attacked in the comments, it's good to have, to be the person helping out, the person standing up and not making it.
Don't you have a lot of Slashdot karma?
I lost track. Like, I had a full karma, at the time they had a cap on it, so you had full karma, and it was actually done in points rather than now it just says you have good or bad. I think I topped out before the year 2000.
Yeah, you're totally geek. All right, let's talk about something completely crazy. Al, tell me about apps that do things you wouldn't expect.
Yeah, well, this isn't... there's a device, and I used to do a lot of these on GeekSpeak years ago, and
crazy users bees of the week.
I used to enjoy doing some of the crazier tech devices out there. Right now, there's one. It's called the Kunkun, which is Japanese for sniff sniff, and it's a device developed by Japanese corporation Konica Minolta, which is not a
fly-by-night
outfit.
What does it do?
It detects bodily odors. And, I think the best thing that you can really do is if you go to the GeekSpeak site and you look at the link, there's a little commercial for this thing. And that commercial is so silly. Because they don't want to smell their armpit. They want to put this device under there so it can tell them whether or not.
I want a real value of how much smells. I stink. I want like a bar graph. I want a percentage of possibility.
It will tell you, it will detect ammonia and isovaleric acid. And that creates this sweaty locker room smell. But it also detects 2-nonylnonol, which is associated with old age, and diacetyl, a controversial organic compound that makes you smell like rancid cooking oil. So you can put this thing and you can point it at your feet and you can put it on your arm and you can tell, it'll tell you, because you need to, you need to carry
it
this around
you
with you.
It can tell you that you are indeed justified in your agoraphobia.
Yes.
I love the idea of having this as like I guess it might not be very cool. I mean, as a parent, maybe of smelly teenagers, you could have it and be like, "You need to take a shower."
It's total contraptionizing your life. Yeah, which brings me to the next contraption, which is actually related to
Did you buy one of these or not?
They're
you bought one, right?
Yeah, no, I didn't buy one.
Oh, okay.
No, you could just buy deodorant. It's probably cheaper.
I wonder if this thing would smell through deodorant. I bet it would. Because it's sensing the chemicals, so the deodorant doesn't stop the chemicals from happening.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, it's called the Kunkun, and it exists.
Thanks.
And you can buy it. So, but if you want to just maybe circumvent that, you can get a Japanese armpit fan. Now, these are...
This is a fan you put in your armpit?
Yeah, this is like a little device, and it's an under the armpit cooling device. And it's kind of like a little fan that clips to your sleeve, and it sort of gives you this blast of cool air in your armpit. It's run on AAA batteries. So then if you buy the thing that detects the smell, you can carry that, but then also get these other things to put under your armpits and have those running. I'm sure they're perfectly quiet and they're not obtrusive at all, and it isn't weird at all.
One of the things that I find convenient about my armpits is that I can close them. I had a fan wedged up in there, I wouldn't be able to put my arms down.
You gotta keep them. Gotta keep that thing in there.
Gotta keep them out. Elbows out.
Just don't do any big gesturing. Another couple of the things out there that are just crazy.
GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence. He's used with permission. GeekSpeak is a Creative Commons attribution from 3.0. So use your stuff anyway. Like, just give us some credit. I want to thank Michael Newman of PetStar Music for the theme song. I want to thank Al Luckow for using your home,
sir,
in the Redwoods, and also for being on the show today. And Miles Elam, thank you. I'm sorry that I've been depressing you about the world. I guess it wasn't really my fault. It's just the state of being.
Always a pleasure.
Moving on to post-show stuff. You didn't cover yet how dangerous it is to buy used cars.
Nowadays, you can unlock your car, honk your horn, do all sorts of things with your smartphone. And yes, that integration is only going to get tighter.
Yeah.
Well, an individual by the name of Charles Henderson sold his car several years ago. But he knows where it is. And he knows how to unlock it and do all sorts of other things with it. Because when someone bought that used car, it didn't disconnect the ability for the smartphone app that he had installed for it to actually do anything, like have a low jack on it.
Oh, God. So it didn't disable the low jack or whatever the system is. He still has that on his phone. Did the other person also have it on their phone? Or they just really know that has a system?
They probably don't even know it's on there.
Don't know. Yeah, they may not know it's on there, and who knows if there is a limit on the number you could have on there.
I mean, there's knobs in my car that I don't know what they do. I had it for like a year. I'm like, I don't really remember what that button does.
Wow, okay, so I don't know what that's like. I totally sat down with the owner's manual and was like, how does this work?
You used a manual? You know, I've...
Yeah, have you seen Honda Odyssey? Setting up my Bluetooth
Dude, I have the same car as you.
Was such a... No, we don't, because you didn't get the leather seats. And so you don't have the backup camera either.
Ooh. Okay, my Leaf...
And that's why you don't like it.
That's why I don't like my car. It's true. Yeah. But I do have the Leaf, and it does have all that. What the Leaf also has is a startup sound. It goes, boom, 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 every time I start it up. Man, I can't tell you how much I hate that thing. And when I know that when I got the car, I was able to pick the sound.
That
was the least offensive one.
Yep.
But now it's been 2 years, and it's really offensive. And I know there's a way to change it, but I can't find it. I guess you're right. I could look at the manual.
Don't do that.
No.
That's like giving up.
Through.
Yeah. I love that. You look at the manual? Ha, ha, ha. You're super... Oh, wait. Look at my manual.
The other thing is my car has one of those fobs that, you know, you get close to the car and you just push the button. And I know those are easy to circumvent, so people can just get into my car anytime they want.
Anyway. So this one, the hypothetical is, what happens if a valet, you know, gets the app and, you know, gets in the car and goes like, oh, what if all you need is the VIN number or something like that and you've figured it out? Then could they revoke your access to the car, you know, if they were
right,
malicious?
Right, and if the app is like unlocks the car and starts it up for you, then that's all you need to steal it.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. So if you have a used car that's a newer used car, because of course now these used cars are hitting the market where they have all these features, make sure you find out who has access to the systems in place. Maybe go pull the cell phone service out of the car.
Right, and you may fixate on cars, but this can apply to everything. Home automation.
My used heart monitor. No, not really.
Yeah.
You start renting
IoT, renting
a place.
Yeah, light bulbs, hey.
I mean, that's where I have a high turnover rate of, you know, every year or two with a lot of people, especially in a college town. You go in there, what happens to the home automation? Cameras are set up. Or
someone installs a Nest and then they leave and then you take over the Nest, but they still have access to it?
Yep.
Interesting.
Actually, I remember when I did that work for Logitech on their security system, when they were selling people would sell the cameras used on eBay and forget to like erase the access. Mm-hmm. So then when the other users would turn them on, the original owner could see, you know, it's a common thing. I mean, that was a little before the IoT business happened, but now, you know, a lot of those things are just wide open.
Yeah. Recently in Germany, there was a doll that had Wi-Fi connectivity.
Mm-hmm.
And The German government was actually telling people, get rid of this doll.
You know what? If this is a scary story about dolls, I just want to, right now, just let me know. I can walk out of the room. I'll come back when it's over.
Hey, there's this movie, and it had a clown.
Dolls and clowns.
We had some feedback a while ago, and maybe we should skip this to a new show, but I just want to acknowledge that we got Pascal contacted us and said, first of all, geeks, first of all, great show, waiting for it every week to then annoy my roommates with it and then tell them all about stuff. I wanted to throw a topic request. Twitter changed its algorithms to favor humans, verified accounts, etc., and they don't put those at the first place that basically... Twitter has originally been chronological or reverse chronological, and then it got a as you missed things in March of last year, this new feature of algorithmic, and then more recently it's changed again, and this is not, it's not denoted how it works exactly. It's not denoted how it works exactly. This is just something that happens when you get algorithmic systems, but it's supposedly better because people enjoy it more. I tried to kind of look at my Twitter timeline tonight, just before the show, to kind of look at to see what it was. And sure enough, it's like most recent, then some stuff that's more important that's less recent, like December 20th was something that was in the feed. And then, you know, quite a bit later down, 55 minutes ago. So it's jumping all over the place, and I couldn't see any reason, and it didn't really declare when I was in chronological and when I wasn't. It's just happening, kind of silently. What do you think about that, Miles? You use Twitter a lot.
Yeah, I see the timeline jump around like that. One thing I have noticed, and this is anecdotal, I don't know, maybe it's because I'm not paying attention close enough, but I've been noticing fewer rape and death threats.
Well, that's nice.
Going to people that I follow.
I mean, I wouldn't say that maybe solve that problem.
Right. Twitter still has...
It's still harassment place.
Twitter still ends up being a wretched hive of scum and villainy. But it also ends up being something wonderful, which is why people stay there. And for tech,
well, it's a move towards personalization. So what you're seeing in the algorithm is the software... we've had... Initially, we would have customization, which we would say, okay...
We control it.
We would say, well, do you, you know, like to run? Are you, you know, do you jog? Do you smoke cigarettes? You know, you could answer things, or you could change. I like, you know, to red. You know, you could do things. That's customization, and those are things that you have to tell the software. We're moving towards what they call personalization, where the software is starting to say, assume things based on your usage, and they're looking at the way people are using Twitter, and they're changing things around. So it's sort of, I wonder if the way that your Twitter feed is looking has something to do with the way you're using Twitter.
Oh, I'm sure it is. Yeah.
And so it's actually personalizing itself to you, and which is the trend in all software. I mean, everybody's trying. We're all trying to do it with apps and everything.
And to be clear, you can actually still turn this feature off. You can actually go into settings, and like 2% of the population has actually turned it off.
That would be customization.
Right. Well, basically meaning, say, yeah, just give me a straight linear.
Right.
And you can also use Twitterific, I think it's an app that allows you to do linear instead.
Right.
But most people don't do that, of course. And I do know a little bit about personalization because we do that a bit at Netflix.
Right.
And, you know, some people have a lot of trouble with this idea. We actually just got a listener emailed in complaining about some of these things that are kind of taking over control for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree that for some people it's frustrating. But these systems work well because for most people it benefits them.
Right.
And so it's one of those things where, and I'm constantly dealing with this problem where, we initiate a new feature because, you know, 95% of the people benefited their experience. And I know that some people aren't going to like the feature, but they're a minority.
Right.
So it's true that the term is personalization. I did a big talk at this a couple of years ago at UCSC. And that's not real personalization. You know, real personalization is a human being does something for you.
Right.
A barber is personalization,
yes,
right? They look at you, they look at the shape of your head, they cut your hair to make it work, right? That's for you from somebody. That's personal service. What we see with an algorithmic personalization is not personal in any way, in the sense there's no people involved. But at the same time, that's what the term is used in tech now.
Right, yeah.
Terms change.
Yeah.
And I agree that this Twitter thing is personalization. And the thing that's concerning about it is Twitter has become an extremely important form of communication in our society. I mean, that's how the president talks to us now.
Right.
So it's a little odd that there is a system in place that mediates that other than your choice of who you want to listen to. Mm-hmm. It's much more about how you'll keep engaged in the service.
There are better examples of people that use Twitter.
Is there?
Yeah. It's more useful than that.
So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that Twitter's doing this. I love that they still can still turn it off. I also think that, I mean, I manage my Twitter account in such that I keep my count of people that I follow mm-hmm. low enough so that I can actually do read all the stuff that I get.
Right.
Not necessarily all the retweets, but mm-hmm. it is challenging to read all. Do you do that, Miles? Do you keep your people that you follow down enough where you can actually read everything?
I used to care about following everything, more and more I'm just getting into this zone of
fatherhood.
I'm not going to watch. Yeah, I'm not going to watch Facebook as closely as I did before. And Twitter, it's like if I miss something, I miss something.
Yeah.
And I'm finding, like, you know what? My life doesn't really feel disadvantaged in any way because I didn't catch every last little iota.
Fancy
of social
that,
media.
Huh?
I would say that, you know, as I don't go, if I don't go on every day and do this intentionally, I miss it. So I don't complete everything. The thing that's kind of odd is that, like, if you tweet something, Miles, I might not see it, right? If I skip a day, I might not see mm-hmm. that tweet. I'd like to see that tweet. On Facebook, I have you tagged as a special friend. Everything you post, I see, right? You too, Al. Mm-hmm. But on Twitter, I don't really do that, mostly because there's not a tool built in that way. I'd have to get a mm-hmm. client to do that. But also because it feels like stuff that's of personal nature is going to be more likely be on Facebook or in person with you. Mm-hmm. And so it's more important. The stuff you put on Twitter is more technical and public, so it's not as important for me to make sure I see it. So don't communicate with me that way.
Unless I'm replying to you and telling you the answer to a trivia joke that you do.
Yeah, well, then if you out-reply me, I see it. That was great. Yeah. What was that? That doesn't matter. You can follow Miles and I on Twitter if you want to see our communication between each other. I think if you follow two people and they talk to each other, you see that in your feed. That's another thing that happens. Mm-hmm. Miles is at Miles Elam, and I'm at Lyle. And Al is on Twitter.
I can't even. Yes, maybe. I got it. Last thing I want is somebody listening to me. I mean, now you can listen to me, but...
Pascal also wrote at the end, P.S., put a don't listen while driving tag on your cast. My girlfriend and I almost crashed because we laughed so hard about you trying to figure out if it's duck or duct tape.
It's both.
It's both. But anyways, do you recall that? Were you in that conversation of duct tape?
Apparently not, because I could have just told you it was both.
No, dude. You got to listen to this episode. We talked about duck and duct tape, Brian, Ben, and I. And yes, I was in tears during it, so I can imagine. Anyway, thanks for the feedback. Love hearing feedback. If it sets us up to talk about something on the show, we'll definitely read it. And you can do that by emailing us. We're geeks@geekspeak.org. Al, please tell me about a new microphone.
Oh, you want to hear about that?
I do.
Oh, that's the other device.
Microphones are important to me.
This was, it's another Japanese device. It's called Hitori D Karaoke DX. And they love karaoke there in Japan. But the problem is it's annoying when you're doing it in front of somebody, like in a crowded area. So they invented this microphone that
basically goes over your mouth. And you put it over your mouth, and you can sing into your phone using this karaoke microphone.
But isn't karaoke about performing in front of other people?
You know what? It depends. I mean, you can sing to yourself. I guess that's what they're doing, because I watched the video of this thing, and, you know, I thought this, you know, it's like a little cup that goes over a mic, and it's just, who's going to want that dumb thing?
It goes over a mic and attaches to your face?
Yeah, you put it over. It's like a, it's like if you had an oxygen thing on. It's like that.
It's like a face hugger, like an
and,
alien.
Yeah,
face hugger.
And I'm like, you know, that's
shows karaoke.
Is there nothing left to invent? You know, and then I'm like reading, and I'm thinking, I'm just looking around and checking different links, and there's like six different companies making these. It's not just the one.
There's a whole bunch of people.
There's like copycats of this. Really dumb actually, thing.
Well, no, there's something kind of intelligent about that. I mean, do either of you sing to yourselves?
Yeah.
When do you do that? When you're in your car?
whenever my daughter is around and then she gets to yell at me and tell me that she doesn't want me to sing.
See, that's just being a dad.
Yeah.
You just embarrass your children. I do that.
Yes,
too.
Except my daughter is always around, so yeah. You ask me right. When, it's like it's always.
That's, see, that's if somebody else is there, you're not singing to yourself. You're singing for yourself, maybe.
I sing in the car. I sing along with music.
I was singing earlier today because no one was in the house, right? So I was able to sing in the house by myself. So
which,
I can
if
kind
you've
of imagine,
heard Lyle sing,
he can belt out a polka like nobody else.
You any day. We're going karaoke, man.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, really?
Oh, definitely.
Well, so, he's an actor. He's like he's been in all those plays.
If
he grew
I can't
up,
sing so better, I can uh-oh. Act like I can sing better. any case, so it kind of makes sense, especially if Miles was one singing, that you would put this thing on their face so that no one else can hear them. I mean, it kind of makes
sense. You can hear it, though, because I watched the demo, and it was all in Japanese, but it just
sounded like the guy was going like this the whole time.
You know, I'm just...
Let it go, let it go.
Pretty much. is there nothing left to invent?
There are some songs.
There's plenty to invent.
That's awesome. Thank you.
Yeah.
We just spend far too much time inventing things that are conspicuously first world problems.
Mm. Speaking of first world problems, well, tell me about this congressman and Trump's Android phone. What's going on?
Well, finally, someone is calling for a probe into checking the security of 45's Android phone. Because that phone is 5 years old. 5-year-old Android phone.
Wow.
Like, you might as so well anyone be... who knows anything about the tech industry...
Runs on coal.
Yeah, that's... assuming that the carrier has tried to do updates, it's still... That 5-year-old phone, it's done. It is running a version of Android that is not secure.
Yeah,
right. Right. When we talk about security vulnerabilities that occur, like, I don't know, things in OpenSSL, like Heartbleed... There's just inherently systems that don't get fixed. And yeah, when it's an old phone like this that's not being sold by the software maker, it's not being sold by Google, it's not like one of the Nexus phones or something, it's being made by a manufacturer that's sold to the telco, and the telco then sells it, you have to have everybody involved in that. Google has to have an operating system for that phone, the manufacturer has to make that available, and then the carrier has to make that available. Those never happen. So a 5-year-old phone like that, no one's paying attention to it, it's got security and vulnerabilities, absolutely. And our president is using it right now for communication.
Yeah, Samsung Galaxy S3.
Wow.
Wow. Well, at least it doesn't catch on fire.
Yeah. There's that.
So, congressman is calling for... And this is a Democratic congressman?
Yes. Ted Lieu
then it doesn't
from
matter.
L.A.
Then it doesn't matter.
That's true.
Nothing's going to get done.
Or...
The thing that's going to happen, though, is like if it's not already compromised, it will. It's compromised already. If you have the president using a non-secure phone, it's already compromised.
Apparently, it's said that he doesn't use the phone for phone calls anymore. He just uses it for Twitter.
Oh, well, then that's fine. Oh, that's why they're so crazy. The Twitter bros are so crazy. Someone else is writing them.
But yeah, the thing is, Trump, in general, legislates through Twitter. Like, he says what he thinks about different issues, and he talks about what he's going to do next, and...
I wonder if you could just, if somebody it has control of his phone, can delay the post for an hour and make transitions on the, or, you know, go ahead and do stock manipulations prior to the tweet getting live, right? You just delay it for half an hour and then buy or sell stock based on what the president's about to say.
That's Lyle always thinking.
Yeah. But yeah, it's from a security standpoint.
I mean, just give
I see
phone.
Stuff like
somebody
this.
Give him a brand new phone. Why does he have an old phone? That's insane.
I know.
He's a billionaire.
Yeah. No, wait. Why is the president tweeting about
Fox
and
stop
Friends?
Don't start using logic. You're already...
You could have stopped your sentences. Why is the president tweeting? You didn't have to say anything else.
Well, Obama tweeted. He tweeted from the POTUS account. Like he would talk about like specific things that were happening, but he never attacked people that... Like individual citizens, let alone people that worked for him.
Well, Al, what should the president do with this phone, do you think?
Well, there is a device out there that he could use, and I know the settings that I would put on it. You're aware of, like, a lot of people are using their phone all the time, and they can't put it down and just can't, you know, it's constant. Well, there's a thing called a smart box.
Wait, Al, what were you saying? I was looking at my phone.
It's a smart box. And what it does is it allows you to lock away your phone for a set period of time. And it's like a little safe. And you put it in there, and it's got a digital LCD readout. It was a Kickstarter thing, and I believe it's available now. And you put your phone in there, and it's called Distractagon.
That's pretty good.
It's Distractagon.
Is it a cube? Or is it a hexagon?
It looks like a little safe, like a little rectangular safe.
It's kind of a cool idea. So basically you say, okay, I'm going to get off the phone for 2 hours. And so you put it in the safe, and then you set the code, and you say, open in 2 hours.
Or you're going to watch a movie, mm-hmm. and I'm just going to, you know, put it in there, and 2 hours, nothing's going to happen. You know, it's like some people need that. It won't open up.
And then your partner calls you and says, I have a flat tire, and you don't know because it's locked away?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
But, you know, you can always say that about anything. You know, I mean, but, you know, you look at the way people are always, especially kids, you know, I mean,
you have this box already in your house. I've seen it.
I do. I've made my own. It's called a cupboard with a lock on it. And, you know, we grew up in both worlds, and now we're seeing kids now that are, you know, they'll just be on their device, you know, 24/7 if you let them. Mm-hmm. And what is that doing? I mean, what really is happening? Because we don't know. We just don't know what's happening to her. I mean, I see my kids, and I have to put the things in a cupboard and lock it up, and they have to earn their iPad time. They have to earn their time with their phone, and then they get it for a certain amount of time. They've got to give it back. Now, I hate to have to do that, but...
it's necessity.
What, you know, I see kids, you know, I went to a birthday party for my 11-year-old son, and I saw a kid there, and, you know, he just, the whole time, he was on his phone doing Pokemon Go, you know, and we went to a movie, and we walked to the movie from the guy's office, and he was doing, you know, that the whole, I mean, you know,
by the way, there's some great software apps available for controlling your kid's usage. I tried one, and I decided not to do it because it's a little too big brother for me. I'm a little more hands-off as a parent,
right.
But you can actually get an account and have your phone registered through that, have your kids' phones registered through it. And then you can specify when the phone's available to run apps and when it's not available to run apps by time of day.
So really?
Yeah, there's a few apps that do that.
Well, but you know, you also have to figure out, you know, my son keeps finding ways around.
No, this is actually part of the operating system. It's the same thing that corporations use for
enterprise.
Yeah, enterprise stuff.
Oh, well, that'd be cool.
I'll give you the account information. Yeah. And I'll mention on the show in the future. Yeah, you can basically say this phone is only a phone at this time.
Right. Yeah. Oh, and since it's related, I might as well mention that there's a movie called Screenagers.
Yeah.
That is a documentary that addresses this exact problem. And you can check out the trailer at screenagersmovie.com, and it really addresses this whole thing about kids, you know, and it doesn't say what's right or what's wrong necessarily, but it sort of outlines the entire problem and what's happening to our kids with all this stuff.
And there's actually an event in Santa Cruz.
Santa Cruz has the Boys and Girls Club. It's a free event, and you can go there. And we'll have links. It's February 23rd, 7 to 9 p.m., Santa Cruz High Auditorium.
Are you going? We should go. I think I'm going to go with
kids. If I can get back from over the hill on Thursday.
Which means you're not doing that. Screenagers. Awesome.
Yeah, a very good thing to look into. And you can also go to that website and request it for your school. You can request a screening, and then they'll do an event with you, and you can set it up, and it's for kids and adults. It's not too little kiddie, and it's not too...
Maybe we should do a Ben Lomond version of that down at Park Hall.
Oh, that'd be cool. Yeah.
Help our fellow parents.
Yeah.
This problem, because it is a serious problem for...
It's an issue, you know, and I don't want to, you know, I'm the last person to say take away their devices, but I also wonder what's happening inside, you know. I mean, they're talking about how their attention span is shifting every 3 seconds. You know, what happens when you do that is you're going to all these places, you're doing all these things, you're online supposedly learning, and when you shift your attention span so much, what happens is you're learning less, but you think you're learning more.
That makes sense.
That's what the psychiatrists are saying. So, I don't know.
Miles, yeah. Thank you, Al. Miles, you have an update for us on a device we've covered a few times. At one time, it was a proof of concept, then it was being sold, and now it's looking really consumer, and it's dangerous.
Yep. This is my crazy USB of the week.
Oh.
No offense,
Al.
Yeah. We've talked about the USB killer. You would charge up this device, and then when it was plugged into someone's USB outlet, it would discharge a very high voltage and fair amount of amperage as well, and fry your motherboard. Like, fry the port at best, and fry the computer at worst.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they've updated it, and they now have versions that can plug into a Lightning or a USB-C device. Lightning being for iPhones, USB-C being
the newer
laptop.
Oh my god, this thing looks just like a USB device.
Yep, and they've redone the stick so it looks more anonymous, so you can't really tell the difference.
The other one said danger on it. This one doesn't do
anything.
Yes,
and you could, and you saw a lot of other circuitry that you wouldn't normally expect with it, and some, and probably there were some visible capacitors.
Is this really for sale right now?
Yeah, for $55.
Oh man.
And I love this byline on Ars Technica about it. Plus, a new stealthy anonymous stick, because that's what the world really needed.
God, this is bad.
Yeah,
okay, so don't put devices, don't put USB
careful
things in
what
your...
you stick in your computer.
Thank you. It's time to buy. It's time to start having like USB condoms to protect us from
little
those things.
Propylaptic plug there.
Discharge fuses.
Yeah.
High access fuses.
Well, they have them, except they're for like power.
They're uncomfortable and most people don't want to use them.
No data gets through.
Speaking of something that no one should use, especially when drunk, can you tell me about this drone?
Oh, yeah. I'm sure you're probably, has everybody seen this drone?
It's going everywhere, yeah.
It's the mega drone.
It's a full size, like a human can sit in it.
It's a self-flying taxi, and of course it's in Dubai,
and it's the size of a grand piano.
Yeah, it's about the size of a piano. Yeah. And it hasn't been completely approved, but
I only said piano because there's a piano behind
a piano right behind me. I'm like, yeah, that's about that big. They're saying the Dubai's Road and Transportation Agency, they want to launch trips with the first fully electric autonomous aerial vehicle drone starting this July. And the prime minister of the UAE wants 25% of all passenger trips to be made in driverless vehicles. Now, if you see this thing, there'll be a link on GeekSpeak.
Just imagine a quadcopter that has a camera on the bottom of it, but instead there's just like a chair.
Yeah, like a quadcopter. It's like a bubble, and the rotors are like right there.
You can get out of this thing and... chop a leg off.
You could just like walk right into one of these rotors. I mean, it's just like a little drone, but like a big one.
Keep in mind that these are direct drive. Almost all propeller systems for these drones are direct drive. I mean, there's a motor connected to the propeller, and therefore, and the propellers are relatively light compared to the mass of the motor.
Uh-huh.
And when you cut off power, those things are going to stop spinning really quick.
Mm-hmm.
So it's most likely by the time the door opens, the rotors are all stopped. So it's not dangerous from that perspective.
Well, the demo, when they show the very handsome bearded man get in it with sunglasses, they're on.
Running while he walks in.
Oh, yeah. He's like walking into it.
That is insane.
I know. It's totally nuts. They say...
There's like a meter of space between the rotor blades, and that's where the door is. There's not much space there.
Right. Not much. I mean, especially if you're going to take this when you're drunk, you know. Because I'm going to take the drone.
Well, that's the whole deal.
Self-flying.
That's the deal with self-driving vehicles, right?
You know,
you can drink all the time with self-driving vehicles.
And they say that, and it's controlled through 4G mobile internet. I'm sure nothing could go wrong there. It'll carry a single passenger who weighs less than 220 pounds over short distances at 62 miles per hour with a fully charged battery.
I wouldn't get in.
So, Dubai, folks. I was thinking, what if, aren't there sandstorms there? I mean, what if you're in one of these things and there's a sandstorm and... That
or,
can't be...
Or a new software bug.
Yeah.
I mean,
or
on.
The cell system, you know.
Or a BB gun. I mean, it seems like a bad thing to
right.
be in.
Or if somebody has one of those drone killer guns. Remember, I did a story on that
How
once.
How about another drone? That's
yeah.
a problem.
Right.
Or a bird.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
I don't know.
You got to see the video. I mean,
Al, you've used the drone. I have friends that use drone. Mm-hmm. Everybody that has a drone has the story of it crashing once.
Oh, the drone I just gave you?
Yeah.
Most of the stuff in that box consists of extra parts for that drone.
Because it crashes
I crashed it so many times that I'd have to keep repairing it. And so I ended up buying extras every time I bought. I might as well buy a whole, like, five of these because I'm going to crash it. So that's why there's so much stuff in there.
Thank you, Al, for the scary drone thing. Speaking of transportation, can you tell us something that's inexpensive now and kind of cool?
Yes. So this is a quick one. Electric buses, now cheaper than diesel and compressed natural gas buses.
Why? Cheaper to run, I'd understand, but cheaper to manufacture? I guess there's so much need for them, they started upping the builds.
Well, battery technology is improving, so the capacity versus the weight and being able to have the infrastructure to charge it compared to the infrastructure for a compressed natural gas.
So we're going to see buses go to electric.
The torque that comes with electric, so much more
useful. Also, with electric vehicle, you automatically have braking reclamation. So with buses, that's a big thing. You stop and start every few blocks. So you're slowing down, speeding up. And in any traditional fossil fuel-based vehicle, natural gas as well, all the braking just goes into braking and friction. But in an electric vehicle, you reclimate some of that with regenerative braking, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah. So this is from the point of view of an electric company CEO. So take it with a grain of salt.
Right.
This is biased information.
He thinks that there could be a switchover within 10 years. But I find that realistic just because I look at the number of electric cars that are getting on the road.
Yeah. But
it's really shifting.
Cars get shipped over a lot faster than public transportation.
I have to be honest. I was personally pleasantly surprised how quickly Santa Cruz buses moved over to like the compressed natural gas. Because I remember going to college in Santa Cruz and having the buses that were spewing the diesel exhaust.
Right.
And I remember the transition going to compressed natural gas going like, whoa, I'm not.
Yeah, but they did that 12 years ago. Have they bought any new vehicles since then? I mean, I'm sure they have, but
yes,
I'm just saying that.
Yes, there is a lag there. But yeah. I mean, new buses are bought every few years. Yes, they haven't twisted the technology for them, but the new models come in more than every 10 years.
The thing is, the big thing about fleet vehicles like this that have a very controlled transportation circle, and we're talking about meter-made vehicle type things and police cars in general for town, you know, police, not sheriffs, but police, and of course public transportation, it's really easy to build in your infrastructure, and once you've done that, it's a lot cheaper. So like this kind of thing is a giant savings from the company, you know, for the town over time. So pretty cool. That's awesome. Glad to hear it. We only have one more story that I am aware of, and that is about traveling with your phone.
This one's more of an open-ended one. I don't know the answer to it. You can go look at the site for the article from Ars Technica where they discuss it. But what happens if you refuse to unlock your phone at a U.S. border? U.S. border is defined as within, I believe, 100 miles of a border.
Oh, really?
Which is... 85% of the U.S. population or up, something like that, lives within 100 miles of a border.
You count coastals as borders?
Yeah.
Really? No.
Yes.
No, because the coast goes out-of-wise.
No, coasts count as borders.
What is the? Wasn't there some rule if you turn off your phone, they can't make you unlock it? They can only do it
is an open question.
Yeah.
I mean, Department of Homeland Security very much says, like, if we want you to unlock it, you need to unlock it. And the Supreme Court rulings have been if you are in a border area, although it hasn't been just in general, it has been limited to points of entry. Although also bus, like, for example, coming up from San Diego, if you go from San Diego to Los Angeles, buses are stopped and pulled off to the side, and you have to show your license and talk to them. Even though you may not have crossed the U.S. border and you are over 100 miles away from the border, or at least you may be...
No, you're within 100 miles of the border.
You're 100 miles.
I mean, to be clear about the... okay, so it's traditionally true that a law enforcement can force you to give something to unlock. So like you can be forced to give a key to something,
right,
but can't be forced to divulge information. So the general rule has been, you know, turn off your phone so you have to be forced to put your password in, and therefore you're
right.
It's
that's
safe.
What I was thinking of.
But
yeah.
The truth is, if you're going across a border and a border agency says unlock your phone and you say no, you're going to spend a lot of time there. Like whether it's legal or not or right. whatever, it's going to be horrible for you as an experience.
And what do they want to do? Hack Facebook page or something? I mean,
let's see. This is an area where a recent story that came up, and this is what prompted the discussion on Ars Technica, was that a JPL, Jet Propulsion Laboratory employee, and an American citizen, was forced to unlock his phone as a condition of returning to the United States,
right,
through Houston Airport, and
so what do you do with this? I mean, if you need to have private information, you don't travel with your phone,
or mail don't it? Put it on your phone. I mean, you know, I mean, it's really a principle thing because. If you're not going to let some, you know, you let people look in your briefcase. Oh, please open your briefcase.
Sure,
you know, you open it. You have to. It's my briefcase.
Yeah,
but
the phone
is
something very different than your briefcase, right? The phone has all the people you know, your complete social network, can emulate who you are in all online communities. Basically, you know, my phone has access to my
access
tax
to your
return
banks.
Information.
Yeah,
right.
Like
it does. It's pretty deep. Yeah,
it's pretty deep. It's interesting. For a while in traveling, the recommendation has been when you travel, especially certain areas, you take a disposable laptop. You know, use a Chromebook or something where you don't have data on it, so that if it gets compromised, it can be wiped when you get back to the office. This is like a standard thing in Silicon Valley. You don't travel to some countries with your machine. You get a throwaway, if you will. Mm-hmm. Same thing has to happen with phones too. I can't see another way around it. You'd have to be in a situation where you're willing to wipe the phone as you travel.
But that's the thing with Chromebooks. That is a password protection to get access to your data, but it's still the common data. That doesn't address the issue of them asking for your password, because right. that still gives access to your data, whether or not it is your primary laptop that is very expensive.
Yeah, so what would stop the border police from saying, hey, here's a laptop in our office, please log into your Google account right now? They could do that too.
Right, and the Supreme Court has given them given border officials wide latitude so that... You know, in these areas, it's kind of a Fourth Amendment free zone.
So we're in the Santa Cruz Mountains, which, of course, is, you know, 10 miles from the ocean. And you could say that's a border, but it's not. Because international waters start 200 miles off the coast or something like that, right? So you're not actually at a border.
Well, U.S. patrols them 200 miles out, but international law does not say they go out 200 miles.
Well, international law doesn't have a figure. It talks about dedicated space or something, right? It says all parts of the sea that are not included in the territorial sea. So whatever that means, the territorial sea, it means that someone's claiming territory of it. Clearly, 200 miles off the coast of California is claimed U.S. territory.
Except there are no Border Patrol agents necessarily going to catch you at 200 miles out. They would get you as you were approaching, which may be within...
Yeah.
Well, you know, like the Russian spy ship Viktor Leninov is at this point loitering off the coast of Norfolk, Virginia, and it's 17 nautical miles out, which is roughly 19 miles from land. And United States territorial waters extend 12 nautical miles from shore.
I'm curious what's going to happen there.
Yeah.
Well, Al and Miles, thank you so much for doing this. We've recorded 2 hours of content. I don't know how much I'll cut that down to, but if you're still here at the end of this show, congratulations.
Wow.
You obviously love
our
show. Episode 7 of season 16, Al, Miles. Awesome. Thanks.
Always a pleasure.
Yep.
Yeah, I hope you get rid of that nice long pause where I completely lost my train of thought.
I didn't mark it, so if I hear it when I'm listening back, I've got to listen to all of this, though, so I don't know if I will. You want to edit it?